Hello and welcome to the humansinvent.com Tour de France podcast. I am Richard Moore and tonight I'm with Lionel Burney.
Evening, Richard.
And Orla Chinoui from Sky Sports.
Good evening, Richard, and thank you for that dramatic introduction.
Our first female guest.
I am honoured. Am I token?
No, nothing token, nothing token about you whatsoever. Okay, so here we are on the top of Alpe d'Huez, and Lionel, you can maybe tell us exactly where we are.
We are outside Chez Juliette, a bar restaurant, and we're sitting on the decking in deck chairs in the cold.
A few of the deck chairs were wet, weren't they? So we had to wipe them down before we could sit on them.
They're dry now.
Excellent, we're just waiting for our drinks. So we've got a lot to talk about today's stage. We're going to talk about today's stage in the first part, then we're going to have a ramble about Alpe d'Huez in the second part. Stop laughing, Orla. You're a professional
it's my
broadcaster.
Default, yes.
Not only are you our first woman, you're our first professional broadcaster.
Well, this is why I'm laughing. I'm high on excitement.
It's a big moment for
it
you,
is
isn't
a big,
it?
Big
this could be your big
moment.
Break.
Yeah, I'm nervous right now.
And then in the third part, we've got a couple of other things to talk about. We're going to talk about Women's Tour de France, not just because we've got a female guest.
Not because of the token guest.
That would smack of tokenism, but... and we'll do our Pedlar de Charme then. We were hoping to be joined by Ciro tonight, but those of you who've heard Ciro before will know that he doesn't like the mountains. He feels unsettled in the mountains and he gets very nervous and anxious. He's a man of the sea and the beaches. So he's declined our invitation tonight, but he said he'll definitely join us tomorrow night. He sent me a text just now to say, don't worry, we will recover.
Tell him we're in deck chairs because that might make him feel a bit more at home.
Our beers have arrived.
You're listening to the Tour de France podcast with humansinvent.com and Sharp.
Okay, we've got our beers and our crisps. Lionel, today's stage, we've been talking about this stage for a long time, two ascents of Alpe d'Huez, the descent of the Col de Sirene, much anticipation ahead of this stage, and a little bit of fear as well on Chris Froome's part. I think the stage, the fear proved not to be justified because the conditions that we expected didn't materialise. There was no rain during the stage. A bit of lightning after the stage, which apparently grounded James Murdoch's helicopter. He couldn't take off. But the stage itself passed without any rain. And I think it did live up to expectations, didn't it?
And more, I think. It was one of the best stages I've watched on the Tour de France for years. What didn't happen? I mean, the first ascent of Alpe d'Huez was... significant because of the size of the crowds and the enthusiasm of the crowds all the way up. I mean, it was a real party atmosphere on the mountain. The descent was sort of edge of the seat stuff, nerve-wracking. The second ascent was a real pursuit match between Riblon and Van Garderen, with the GC battle just behind that, more intriguing than we probably could have hoped for. Some real surprises. Chris Froome looking like he ran out of gas a bit, got the hunger knocks, needed some food, took a gel outside or inside the last 6 kilometres, for which Sky got a penalty and Froome got a 20-second time penalty. You know, there was just so much happening today. It was one of those stages that we will look back on in years.
I think that's James Murdoch.
he must be a happy boy with his man in yellow. But yeah, it was one of those stages that we will look back on in years to come and say, do you remember the double ascent of Alpe d'Huez? And I think there'll be clamours for ASO to repeat that. But I think it would be a good idea to sort of leave that as something to stand in the record books as a sort of unique stage, really.
Maybe for the 200th tour. I mean, there was a lot you didn't mention there. There was Riblon riding off the road on the descent of the Sirene. He was away with Van Garderen and Moreno Moser, who's a rider that we've been talking about a lot. We were, you know, looking forward to seeing him in this tour. Riblon won a stage exactly 3 years ago to the day at Aix-Trois-de-Maine. And Van Garderen came here with overall ambitions, which collapsed really in the Pyrenees. He suffered. I think the heat was a problem for him there. And it was a terrific pursuit between those two. And then there was so much happening behind as well. We saw Contador attack on the Col de Sirene, as he said he would. He went away with Kreuziger. Didn't get much of a gap. Movistar actually did a lot to close that move down, although Froome had more teammates today than other days. The team looked stronger today. And then there was an odd incident when Contador and Kreuziger were caught. Contador had a bike change. This came just moments after the UCI announced a surprise bike check at the finish. As Jonathan Votter said after the stage, why did they announce a surprise bike check? That was odd. And there was obviously a lot of speculation as to why Contador had a bike change shortly after the announcement of the bike check.
Is the suspicion that it was an underweight bike rather than a power-assisted?
Power-assisted? Were you thinking that he had a motor in his bike?
I don't think so, no. But, I mean, it could well... allegedly.
It wasn't a very powerful motor, unfortunately, if he had it in, I think.
Should have changed the motor, maybe, not the bike.
Exactly. But
probably an underweight bike.
If he did change onto a heavier bike, I think we saw the effects of that second time up. I'll do it. It's when he really did start to struggle. And I've never seen Contador look like that. You know, glasses off, looking... human, looking normal, and draw whatever inferences you want from that. But he didn't look like the Contador of a few years ago.
I think that was one of the things today, the seesawing of the racing. Riders looking good one moment, bad the next, recovering a bit, measuring their efforts. The pursuit match between Van Garderen and Riblon, it was joy and heartache for those two riders. But you saw Riblon almost sort of puff up when he could see Van Garderen ahead, and I think that's echoes something he was saying yesterday on the podcast about the sort of psychological effect of racing on riders. You know, when you get that boost of seeing your opponent up the road ahead of you, you could see Riblon, even through the TV screen, you could see him, gain extra strength from that and put in the extra effort. While meanwhile, Van Garderen was starting to look over his shoulder, had everything to lose. And I mean, that's what we want from bike racing, isn't it? That's what got us interested.
One of the things that I actually thought about watching that was... that Lance Armstrong and the EPO years denied us that spectacle that we had today. And I don't want to sort of say, doping is a thing of the past, but I think that spectacle that we had today was one that we didn't have throughout, for much of the 90s and into the 2000s. We've said this before. I remember when Floyd Landis collapsed in 2006, people said, oh, it's a sign that things are cleaner. So I'm wary of jumping to that conclusion, but I did feel that today was a stage that we never used to see in that particular era. Orla, you're a Francophile. You must have enjoyed that stage win.
Certainly my husband was jumping up and down, I think, back home in the living room. Finally, a French stage winner this year. So it only took 18 stages. That'll keep the headline riders happy, I think, though. They've been a bit distracted with lots of other chat, I think. For tomorrow, at least, the pressure might be off Chris Froome a little bit, and they'll be talking about Riblon instead. And I think that's a good thing for the race, really. I think in the centenary edition, the home crowd really needs something to cheer because they haven't had very much so far.
Should we not be asking for Riblon to release his power data from today and release
it to an
English newspaper?
Yes, I'll put in a request. Maybe Sky Sports should pursue that.
Maybe one day we could not talk about power data. How's about that? How's about actually just analysing the performance on the road? Am I being a bit naive?
No, not at all.
The Tour de France with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
Tell us about your day, though, Orla. You were obviously covering for TV here. First time to Alpe d'Huez?
It isn't my first time to Alpe d'Huez, certainly for a bike race.
You've been skiing here?
I've been skiing here before, yeah. It's not quite the same. Going downhill on two planks.
Good for skiing?
Fantastic for skiing. I'd rather go downhill than uphill. But I was tempted, actually, going up it yesterday, but then I don't have an entire... 21 hairpin road of supporters egging me on, so it might be a little different if you're doing it by yourself, but I thought it was absolutely fantastic. It's so different from any mountain top finish that I've done because you've got the resort up here and because you've got people camping out overnight. I mean, last night in
James
time,
Murdoch is just flying,
he's taking his time,
us.
Isn't he?
James, will you leave us alone? We're trying to do our podcast.
Yeah, I just thought the atmosphere was fantastic, and that really is what the tour is all about, because it is really quite disheartening, I suppose, when you're covering a bike race and wanting to be talking about the racing and wanting to be talking about the riders, and you've got to be talking about all the other issues and suspicions and all the rest of it. I think today was just pure celebration of the sport, and we stayed up here last night. There's a fantastic party in town, these two Luxembourg DJs entertaining everyone in the street. Gotta love a bit of Luxembourg tunage, and everyone dancing in the street until the police literally shut it all down. And I just thought, right, we've got a party on our hands here. And today, really
lived
up to it.
Were you the last person there?
I couldn't possibly comment. Yeah. But no,
you've
of course not.
Form. Yes, I remember in 2007, was it Frank Schleck won up here? It was in 2007, and I remember the Luxembourg party that night was extraordinary.
I think
the entire country was here.
I wouldn't be surprised if half the country were here last night and today.
Easily.
It was incredible.
And Andy Schleck put on a bit of a show for them today until he fell back on the final climb. But I thought, you know, when he attacked the first time up Updays, I thought, this is the old Andy Schleck is sort of coming back. Didn't last, unfortunately. Ireland as well. Irish Corner.
It is a new innovation. Yeah. I quite liked it. I did my best to get every paddy I could on the channel today, just in honour of that. But yeah, it's great. The Irish fans are really, really taking to it. We haven't really had much to cheer about in Ireland, you know, since Sean Kelly and Stephen Roach. So it's great now that we do have riders at the very top, and that it's really becoming a massive sport. I mean, you go back home and the difference from whenever I was younger, you see everyone out riding on the roads and they're really, really taken to it. And I just think that's, you know, it's a knock-on effect of the British success as well. You've got that home island thing. So yeah, it's great. I hope one day we can rival Dutch Corner and
have a bit of rivalry going on there.
Irish Corner was great. It was all green, the tricolours were out, everybody was... They looked like they were getting stuck into the beer. I'm not sure.
Really?
I'm not sure that there was.
Never.
I'm not sure there was much Guinness being drunk because it's not a great.
Doesn't travel well,
does it? It's not good out of cans either. So
I don't want to disparage my fellow countrymen, but we're not really that fussy, to be honest.
Speak for yourself, Orla.
The Dutch.
Let's talk about the Dutch. There must
have been a football stadium's worth of people on that corner.
I've never seen so many people. There was a lot of talk on Sunday about how big a crowd was on Mont Ventoux, but today was it's the shortest climb, but it was on a different scale today. It was literally lined the entire way up on both sides with, as we drove up, just thousands of people streaming up the road, walking up the road for miles, you know.
It was quite incredible, and Mark Cavendish tweeted that the Dutch fans were even kind to him. So
yeah, well, he must have been a bit worried about that, was he?
I think I would have been if I was him.
Well, my photographer friend was on Dutch Corner, and he said that the riders in the gruppetto or the bus were taking beers from the Dutch fans as they came.
They were
up
in a bus?
Well, the colloquial name for the last group on the road.
The autobus.
The autobus. And yeah, the Dutch fans were handing out beers to the riders, and they...
Really?
One or two of them were taken. I'm looking forward to seeing his pictures and trying to identify who it was.
Surely under strict tour rules that's about as illegal as Chris Froome's unfortunate jail taking.
It's further than 6K from the finish. You can have what you want.
That's a good point. Chris Froome could have done with a beer,
perhaps. He could have done an instant sugar hit. I mean, you mentioned
Murdoch. Have we talked about Froome's...
Not really.
Hunger knock. Not really.
Well, I spoke to Nicola Portal afterwards, at Team Sky DS, who... unfortunately had James Murdoch in his car today.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. So that must have been made for interesting chat. But Nico was very open. He said, you know, he went up to the commissaires actually just as we were about to go live on Sky Sports and promised he'd chat to us afterwards. So he said he just went up to them to tell them exactly what happened. He said, no excuses. He said, I take full responsibility. It was my decision. Apparently, Chris Froome called for food and it was his decision, and they had a mechanical and so they couldn't get up to him before the 6K, and it was his call really as to whether to risk it or not. Decided actually, well, you know, Chris Froome, you know, is a race leader, he's their team leader, he wants food. I presume the priority then is to deliver that and then pay the consequences afterwards. He was actually a bit concerned at that stage that he would be kicked off the race,
Nicole,
as well, yeah, as well as the time penalty. He was hoping obviously not to be, but when I spoke to him he didn't know yet. He was hoping to hear from the commissaires later, but he just wanted to explain to them and ask for a bit of lenience, I think, because it was the yellow jersey team, whether that makes a difference.
It's an odd rule.
It is an odd rule. I mean, the idea, I think it stems back to not being able to take a pull from a bottle or a pull when you're handing over in the last 6K.
Yeah.
So I mean, there's a perfectly valid reason for it. I thought Sky perhaps were a bit trying to be a little too cute by getting Port to collect the gel or the bar or whatever it was and then hand it over to Froome. I think they might have been able to plead mitigating circumstances if they hadn't tried to be a little bit clever about it. And if Froome himself had got it and then Portal could have said, look, we had a problem. I mean, the crowds were so big, it must have been hard getting cars up to riders anyway.
Yeah, Froome was penalised 20 seconds. He may have lost more had he not had that gel, because we've all been there. We've all had that hunger knock when you, on a bike, more than running or anything else I've found, that on a bike, when you get that kind of sugar flat, you're empty. And on a climb like this, you can just, you know, we've seen riders before, you know, just stop pedaling. You know, it's very hard to keep going when you just your energy is just so depleted. And that it was a very... I think that Froome had the same thing in 2008 when he rode the Alpe d'Huez stage, I believe. He suffered a hunger knock then and said afterwards, I'll not make that mistake again.
Is it okay to admit that I've got hunger knock now as well?
But Lionel, you've been tucking into those crisps to such an extent that I'm actually going to take them away because I've not had any because I'm worried about making crunching noises on this podcast. I've got some respect for our listeners.
I might get criticism, but I think Nico did the right thing. I think, you know, if you've got the race leader in your team, he's asking for food. And as you say, it can have a massively detrimental effect on the rest of it. He really needed to keep his lead today. Fair enough, he's within the last 6K. He was safe enough. But if he's going to lose more than those 20 seconds, then what would you do? I think you would. The smart man would go up.
Yeah, the thing with the rule is that the penalty is usually 20 seconds for that offence. And if you're an hour down, it doesn't make any difference whatsoever. If you're in the top 10, it makes a huge difference. But so it's not even quite a fair kind of rule.
Yeah.
The penalty
yeah.
isn't quite fair because, you know, a certain strategy, you know, you can't second guess when your rider's going to need something to eat.
No.
And if that had happened to somebody in the middle of the pack, it wouldn't be an issue.
It was surprising, though. What surprised me was that just before that, Froome had looked so full of energy, and in fact, he was encouraging Quintana to ride just a few hundred metres, really, before he suddenly... But I think we've all probably experienced that as well. It does hit you quite suddenly. The man with the hammer.
This is the humansinvent.com Tour de France podcast, powered by Sharp.
So that was a little bit of Alpe d'Huez atmosphere there, playing us in to the second part of our humansinvent.com Tour de France podcast. Orla just took a crisp just before I started recording this section. She's now sort of, you're hoping it'll dissolve, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah.
You're trying to use saliva to...
We've all
been there as well. Anyway, you know, it's very considerate
of you. It's gone down. We're fine.
Just keep me away from Lionel.
As you were.
So Alpe d'Huez, this is your first time, Orla, but this is one of the iconic climbs of the tour, and there are some great stories here. I can't remember how many times I've been up here now, but I think you spoke to Graham Jones, didn't you, earlier today about his experiences riding here?
I did, yeah. He rode in 81 and 83, I think it was, and he talked through his experiences of riding on the mountain. He was a teammate of Jean-René Bernadot, the Europcar team manager, so we talked a little bit about that. And Graham is, of course, a member of BBC Five Live's commentary team, so he shared some of his thoughts on his role working on the race too. Okay, I'm here with Graham Jones. Graham rode the tour several times. Best result was in 1981, finishing 20th overall. And that was, I gather, your first experience of Alpe d'Huez in the Tour de France?
It was. I'd never even seen it, even in training in those days. We did very little recces in the mountains, or even what you might call a stage training camp in the mountains. So it was my first look at it. And unfortunately, I had a bit of an unfortunate time by having to drop back for Phil Anderson. We'd had a long day that day. We did the Madeleine and Glandon before we got to Alpe d'Huez. I think it was something like 6 hours plus before we even got here. And Phil Anderson was in the white jersey. I had to, and I was sent back, went in the leading group to go back and wait for him, only to be told nearer the summit eventually, leave him, he's dead. And did my chase, and almost got back onto the leading group on the Glandon, so I never quite got on and ended up not being in the leading group at the bottom of the Alpe d'Huez. But it was still a reasonable stage placing for me.
Who was the team manager? That was the Peugeot team at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Maurice Demure, obviously, one of the old school team managers, had managed Ocaña, Jan Janssen, people like that in the Tour wins. So
he's up there with the sort of Jean de Gribaldis and the Lomdriesens as one of the legendary directeurs sportifs. So it strikes me as odd they have this such fearsome reputation, but they didn't think of exposing their riders to something like Alpe d'Huez in training before race day.
No, it's such an odd thing now, because it seems such an obvious thing to do now. Very normal, almost essential, really. You'd be silly not to do it. But no, it just wasn't done. I think, the climate was different then. We raced a lot more, so finding the funding and maybe the time to go and do these sort of things was probably more difficult.
The philosophy then was you raced to get fit in the smaller races. Training camps were something for the start of the season then, rather than something that maybe a Sky team would go off and do a mountain camp in April or May. That just didn't happen in those days, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even myself, who probably didn't race as much as some people, like even a Sean Kelly, but I still did 120, 130 days of racing some years. And now it's, you know, riders do probably maybe just over half that, so you have got that time to go and train and target specific events, so it's a little bit different.
So you came back here to Alpe d'Huez in 1983 with the Wolber team, and your team leader was Jean-René Bernardeau, who is the boss of Europe Car now. Tell me a little bit about him, because he had ambitions to try and win that tour, didn't he?
He did. He was going really well. We'd prepared for it well. We'd all ridden the Giro before, so I did the Giro Tour Double that year. And came into the tour going really well, but probably not real sharpness, so I was always going to be there. So I was actually told to just not worry about trying to finish 15th or whatever it was, but just we were there to support Bernardeau. So in the Pyrenees, it was one of those cases of get through the Pyrenees and look at the opportunities where we could help Jean-René. And we had a specific target that day of attacking Fignon. I mean, Pascal Simon was in yellow, but had been suffering, and it was only a matter of time before he had to abandon with his broken collarbone. And we had a plan. We attacked very early on. It's a fairly common sort of thing now, is to send teammates up the road. Your team leader attacks from behind, and you ride like mad over the next couple of climbs and in the valleys to try and establish that gap. And it worked perfectly. I do seem to remember that Jean-René was actually Mayo Jean on the road on the Alpe d'Huez. But for some reason in his head, he started thinking, I'm going to win the stage. And he started thinking about the stage too much and not about going for it, and in the end he messed up both, really, because even now it still riles him so much that he messed up that sprint, because there's no way he should have lost that sprint to Peter Winning. Jean-René was always a big gear man, and he sprinted in a little ring from the last corner, and I've never seen anybody more sick at losing a race than Jean-René that day.
Are you still in good contact with Jean-René? And what do you think of the way he manages the Europe Car team? He's just secured more sponsorship for that team, which, you know, isn't an easy thing to do in this economic climate with the kind of goals and results that they get. But in terms of his management style, how would you assess him?
I think he's great for the sport, and you won't meet a more enthusiastic man about the sport than ever. I mean, when he retired, when Wolber pulled out, he spent a lot of time trying to get System U team going. That was the first appearance of the System U team. It later developed into the bigger System U team, but he had that in his mind already. And then when he retired from racing, he went into the Vendée U, the amateur scene, and eventually developed into the pro scene. And I'm astonished at how well he does every year to find the sponsors and keep going. And, you know, and all credit to him. He doesn't necessarily go for all the big riders, the stars, all the time, but he very much supports the French riders in his teams, and it's great to see that he can still exist when you've got the massive budgets of a Katusha or a Team Sky.
I think I'm right in saying Charlie Wegelius rode for Vendée U as an amateur for maybe a year or perhaps two.
Yeah, he did. I don't think he had the best of times at Vendée U for some reason, and I know he doesn't speak too highly of Jean-René, but you know, everybody has different opinions of people, different experiences, but for me he's a great character for the sport.
Finally then, on today's stage, we've got the two ascents of Alpe d'Huez. Perhaps the race is a couple of hours away from us at the moment. The sky is overcast, but it's not raining yet. The forecast is for a bit of rain this afternoon. What do you think about the plan to go down the descent of the Col de Sirene and have two climbs of Alpe d'Huez? Because on paper it seems, you know, a real special thing for the 100th tour, but perhaps not everybody's in favour today.
No, I think it's split 50-50. I know there's been a lot of banter with riders. Some are saying, look, just get on with it. We're pros. That's what we have to do. We looked at it in the Dauphiné, and, you know, it seemed to go okay. I don't think anybody took any real risks there. But You know, it's, I mean, Alpe d'Huez is not the hardest col in the world. It's this mythical, you know, place where everybody goes to. It is the most famous climb in the Tour. But it's not the hardest. I did an interview with Bernardino the other day, and I said to him, what's the Alpe d'Huez? And he says, well, it's mythical climb. It's not the hardest. It's not the Glandon. It's not the Tourmalet or the Galibier. But it's got this thing about it. And he said, the fact of going up in it twice is no different than going up any other two cols in the Tour, except that it's Alpe d'Huez. So it's going to have a massive, it's going to be a massive atmosphere on the climb. So I think it will be a great spectacle. I think the ones who'll be looking forward to it least will be the ones who are out the back, really, the autobus, going up it once and then thinking, I've got to go up it twice. That can be pretty hard.
This is a humansinvent.com Tour de France podcast with Richard Moore and Lionel Burney.
That was Graham Jones. We've all had our energy gels while we were waiting for him. I sent my Richie Port, Lionel Burney, back to the team car for
to fetch some
sustenance. Yes, so Alpe d'Huez, we were mentioned. Oh, Lionel, come on. Crunch, crunch. We were talking about Alpe d'Huez. It is a different mountain. It's different to any other mountain. The fact that the Dutch have a corner, the Irish now have a corner. I can see that becoming a trend, actually. There'll be a Slovakian corner next time.
There almost was. Peter Sagan corner is definitely, you know, Roman Kreuziger corner. Because the fans who come from... it's a bit like when the England football team plays and you look in the crowd and all the flags are from sort of Torquay and, you know... Bishops,
other places in England.
Bishops Auckland. Yeah, but not places where necessarily Manchester United, Everton, you know, Liverpool.
Got you.
And there is something about that. You know, the Luxembourgers are still here in huge numbers, despite the fact Frank Schleck isn't here and Andy Schleck is today apart riding like a sack of spuds. So.
Is that an Irish reference? Is that because I'm here?
No.
Because that's racist.
I have Irish heritage, so the joke's on me.
Nobody ever could ever compare you to Sack of Spuds or that. But Alpe d'Huez, I was thinking that back to some... I'm going to tell a story now about one of the more infamous ascents of Alpe d'Huez. Lionel, don't look at me like that. Should I not tell this story?
No, tell it. I'm sitting back to listen.
All right, okay.
That's Jack and
Ori position. Was it 1978, I think? And it was the year that Lucien Van Imp, the great Belgian climber, won the race overall. No, he won it in 76.
No, it was Bernardino on his debut.
Apologies.
In 78.
But the tour I'm talking about was in 76 then, wasn't it, with Palencia?
No, 78.
78. I don't know why I'm...
He was a teammate of Sean Kelly's.
Yeah.
It was Sean Kelly's first tour. Yeah. Freddie Martins were on the team.
Okay, Flandria
was
a
This is a good story of yours, Richard.
It's really good. I don't know why I had a sort of mental block there over what year it was, but it's 78, you're absolutely right. And Michel Pelletier, the Belgian, one up here, crab-like Belgian, wasn't a super stylist. He was a bit sort of, dare I say, Dan Martin-esque in his style on the bike. And he won up here. He then went for a drug test, and he was caught with what was politely described as apparatus on his person, which has always been reported as being a bulb of clean, i.e., somebody else's urine in his armpit, with tubes leading down to the appropriate place to deposit said sample in the flask. Now, I recently interviewed Freddie Martins, who was his teammate and in fact his roommate that evening, and he described the commotion and the, you know, the press trying to get into the room all night and how crazy it was. Plenty was thrown off the race,
having won the stage, having won the stage and taken the yellow jersey.
And I asked Freddie Martins about this, and he corrected me on one thing that has always been reported, the idea that the bulb of urine was in his armpit. He said, no, it wasn't in his armpit. It was in his bottom. So there's a little revelation for tonight.
The people in Orla. Charge...
smelling salts for Orla, please. we need...
The thing about that was that a Spanish rider, whose name escapes me, had tried the same thing earlier on, in either that day or earlier on in the tour, and they were wise to it. They were looking out for this, as suspecting that riders were trying to cheat the dope control with a fresh sample of urine. And that's that... an eagle-eyed doctor or member of the jury basically rumbled Pelletier, and yeah, you're right, he was sent home Freddie Martins, I think, still had the green jersey, so there was a bit of debate about whether the Flandria team would carry on to Paris, but the sponsors were here, and they said, no, you go on to Paris and try and win another stage.
I always did find the armpit
story
a little bit implausible, to be honest. So the bottom makes sense. That's my sole contribution to that.
Yeah, there's something about that I find quite implausible as well, but maybe not. Not go into that.
We'll not go there.
But he did say it was interesting because Palencia was sent home in disgrace, I suppose. And he had to serve a little suspension, which meant he missed a lot of the post-tour criteriums. He was still invited by the organisers of those criteriums to turn up, to put in an appearance. The public, it didn't alter at all their perception of him, and he would be required to sort of turn up and wave at the crowds and stuff. It was a different time, I think.
Well, isn't that often still the case, though, depending on the country, depending on the rider, and depending on where the race is? I don't think we're at the stage whereby dopers are.
Well, I remember when Contador was serving his suspension, he would be appearing at Spanish races sometimes. And
you only have to look at some of the riders that were allowed to the start line of the Giro d'Italia.
Yeah, yeah.
There was
no
surprise when they were caught, so the fact they were allowed to start at all, I don't think it's changed all... It's obviously changed a lot, but probably not as much as we would like to think of.
Probably the other most famous Alpe d'Huez finish, famous this time rather than infamous, was 86 when LeMond and Hino arrived together at the summit hand in hand, having fought this bitter war, the two teammates, over the previous 2 weeks. And that was a very famous finish. L'Equipe recreated that, actually. In today's paper, there was a picture of LeMond and Hino a couple of weeks ago crossing the summit hand-in-hand again, which was incredible to see.
What I loved about that stage was that they obviously tried to come across the line together, presumably intending a dead heat, and the French organisers weren't going to have any of that.
Well, I don't think Hino intended a dead heat.
No.
I think... Hino made sure that he was just slightly ahead of LeMond, I think.
And of course, in 2001, there was the look, wasn't there, when Lance Armstrong...
Apparently that didn't happen, according to the record books.
It now hasn't happened, but when it had happened...
It now hasn't happened. The look from someone the non-existent look from the non-existent rider.
It didn't actually happen.
But basically, he...
It would have been a great story if it did, though, wouldn't
it?
It would, yeah.
Let's imagine it.
If it had happened, this is what happened. He kind of sandbagged earlier in the stage, didn't he? Tried to pretend that he was suffering and that he had a bit of hunger knock.
Is that what Froome was doing today, didn't he?
Well, I don't think so, no.
Let's not go there with the comparison.
No. And T-Mobile, which was Ulrich's team, they completely bought it, didn't they? And they got a bit aggressive on the lower slopes and thought they had Armstrong on the rack for the first time in it would have been 3 years. And then Ulrich kind of ran out of gas a little bit and Armstrong just powered away. And there was this sort of almost choreographed moment where Armstrong, out of the saddle, turned and looked back at Ulrich and then just left him for dead, really. And that was also the day, I'm gonna out myself.
Oh yes,
here.
Brilliant. Yeah. This is a great story.
Also the day that I rode up Alpe d'Huez in full US postal kit, including socks and gloves, I think.
Before the yellow wristbands, unfortunately.
Before the yellow wristbands, I didn't have one of those. But yeah, full US postal kit. It was a bit of an experiment because that tour, 2001, was kind of when Armstrong and the French had fallen out a bit. Earlier in the year, Armstrong had announced his race programme for the season and very pointedly had left off every French race. So he wasn't going to do Paris-Nice, he wasn't going to do the Dauphiné. The only French race he was going to do was the Tour de France.
And he just moved from Nice to Girona, hadn't he?
Yeah, I think he had. He'd certainly moved. I don't know how soon before this. But he was definitely trying to provoke the French a little bit. And he was actually booed at the team presentation in Dunkirk at the start of the race, and it was.
Were
just
you booed in your full kit?
Well, that was why I did it. I did it as a kind of let's see what the reaction is on the mountain, and I think it was probably about 50-50. There were quite a few people who were mocking, but there were.
Were they your friends though?
Yeah,
mainly.
Yeah, running alongside all the way up because I basically rode up at no more than running pace anyway. So
don't exaggerate, Lionel.
Crawling, all fours.
Yeah, and there was a bit of hostility. They definitely weren't popular at that time. But there were an awful lot of Americans on the mountain as well who were, cheering me on, go Lance.
Do you know what, though, speaking of hostility, and really not to try to compare those situations at all, but I had a friend who was 2.5 kilometres from the summit today, and he said that when Chris Froome and Team Sky rode past, that they were booed by a large number of the crowd, and I find that quite sad in a way, really. I mean, I don't know what your take on all of this is. I kind of think an awful lot of...
You've not been listening to our podcast? Or...
Well, I have, but I thought I'd bring it up afresh for...
Yeah.
No,
I mean, we've talked about this a lot, obviously. And today, of course, L'Équipe published... they had been given Chris Froome's power data dating back to the 2011 Vuelta, and had Fred Grapp, Francis Dujeux, physiologist, study this. Unfortunately, somebody then dug out an article from 2001 where Fred Grapp had declared Lance Armstrong's performances to be believable, which is unfortunate. But I think probably the science has moved on a bit since then, and he's used his current sort of analyses to look at this data. And I guess what he's looking at is not comparisons with Lance Armstrong, but fluctuations in Chris Froome's, as it relates to Chris Froome. I think that's the key thing here. I think it's relevant to the individual. I don't think we know enough to be able to compare it to other people, and that's, I think, what he's studied.
That's kind of my point, though, because I think that it's all very well to have reasoned scientific analysis if you take the time to read it, but I think when I say sad, I find it a bit disturbing that so many people can take a headline. We're all on Twitter, we know how it works. And just run with it as fact. And I think, I mean, I do a daily blog for Sky Sports in the Tour at the moment, and it was a subject on my blog the day after the second rest day. I think I lament somewhat that core principle of journalism whereby you need more than mere suspicion
to go to Twitter,
because I've pointed out, I had someone tweeting me something libelous, and so I tweeted back and said, you are aware of the laws of libel and that they apply to Twitter. And he said, no, I've never heard of that. And I just put my head in my hands and I thought, that is what is getting out there as fact, because it grows, and the more of a body of suspicion you have, the more that just becomes inevitably irrevocable. And I find that element of it quite disturbing, because then people do actually pick up on it, and I think that booing hasn't come from people analysing the power data at all.
No,
it's
first.
Come from people reading simplistic binary headlines and following Twitter. I'm not trying to say in any way that I know what goes on in any team, but I find that sort of presumption of suspicion just a little bit upsetting.
On the subject of booing, I mean, sport is very partisan. You have favourites and you have people that you don't particularly like. I mean, the crowd in a football stadium can be pretty objectionable at times. I don't find necessarily the booing is necessarily correlates to this argument about the power data. I mean, Chris Froome probably didn't endear himself massively to fans with all of his suggestions about taking out the descent today, rain. You know, they're the sort of things that people instinctively kind of think, oh, come on, man up, it's a bike race. We want to see the kind of carnage without it going too far and becoming too much of a risk to riders. I think the problem with booing is that it becomes a story in itself, and it did become a story early on when the report of Chris Froome being booed at a sign-on suddenly grows a life of its own, as if that's demonstrative of his unpopularity with a wider group of people. It was, at best, a handful of people.
Basques, Euskaltel supporters.
Yeah.
And so to what extent, then, are we, and I use we in the collective, responsible journalists, reporters, because we do then report this story if it is just a small group of people, and I'm guilty right now because I've just said it, I didn't know it had happened, it was my friend on a certain point in the route, that might have been the only point in the route today, but to what extent then should we be, I suppose, putting that into context and not always reporting it, or if we do that, are we seen to be defending the riders who are being booed? I mean,
it's a bit like reporting the suspicion, and as we said in our very first discussion on this topic, the evidence that somebody is doping is whether they're doping. Are they doping? That is the fundamental question. The suspicion could grow out of absolutely nothing at all. And, you know, we've mentioned a couple of times people who've kind of kept an open mind on it, that we might be witnessing, and let's face it, probably are, I think, witnessing an exceptional clean athletic performance. And that's what the L'Equipe story supported today. You could pick holes in that as well. You always can pick holes in it. But I think it supported that. I think it was probably a good move by Team Sky to release that data to L'Equipe in the absence of anything else. There has been this clamour for the release of public data, of power data. That's been done. I'm sure they will look for other ways to prove themselves. We had an interview with the Team Sky doctor last night. You know, it's a difficult situation. It is the legacy of the past, and it's sometimes funny to hear people who were deeply involved in that past sort of say to the, you know, current riders and so on, guys, you just got to deal with this. It's a legacy of the past. When those were the those were the people who were
sticks in the throat, somewhere.
Massive players, actors in that past. It was interesting. I mean, at the stage finish, Christophe Riblon, the stage winner, was asked a little bit about this, and he said, you know, that the suspicion that the fact that the yellow jersey was on trial, he found very regrettable, and he talked a little bit about that. We have to eradicate the cheats, but we also have to eradicate the suspicion. He said, easier said than done. So here we still are, Lionel Burney and Orla Chinoui, for the humansinvent.com Tour de France podcast. Let's talk briefly. We've got a couple of things to get through. One is our famous pedalar Deschamps. But let's talk a bit about the women's Tour de France, because this has become a campaign. I remember the Tour de France Féminin in the 80s when Jenny Longo and Maria Cannons, the Italian, were dominant. Jenny Longo would probably still be up there in some way, shape or form. And, you know, for a while, you know, I remember in 84, maybe 85, they shared the podium in Paris with the men, and there was a sort of, it was, because it was held at the same time and they had the same yellow jersey and so on, there was definitely, it had some kind of momentum back then. That was obviously then lost. Now there's a clamour again for new women's
Tour. It was one of Félix Levitin's innovations, was to have the women's Tour de France, and then when he was kind of ousted from the Société du Tour de France, they stopped the women's Tour de France in its tracks. They just cancelled it. They had been organising it, and they just decided they weren't going to have it. Logistically, it was very awkward. I mean, they tried to run sort of half-length stages on much of the same course, and the size of the Tour de France now is so much bigger than it was then. They'd have to be a bit creative about how they
really
did it.
I don't really see how that couldn't happen, and it would give people, you know, so much more entertainment. I mean, I just don't see how it can happen. When you consider that stages start about midday or 1 o'clock, you know, there's a whole morning, and the roads have been closed all that time anyway, pretty much.
I think it would be absolutely fantastic. I'm always surprised, in a way, when I come to the Tour de France as a spectator, just at the massive build-up that you get all day, and everyone's really excited, and they're phoning their friends or watching on TV, and how far away is a peloton? They see the helicopters coming overhead, and they know that they're on their way, and then it's over in a few minutes, and everyone goes home. And it's fantastic for what it is, but if you had another race coming through a few hours before, it would be fantastic. And as they used to do, modify the start and finish. What Emma Pooley, for example, is saying is, why do we have to? Okay, the UCI rules say that they can't race certain length of stages, but they're saying, well, you know what? They used to say that women couldn't run marathons, and that's antiquated.
Yeah.
Why not give? If they say they can ride it, surely it's up to the athletes themselves to know what their limits are and know what they can push themselves to do. And I think it would be amazing. And I was the Olympics correspondent for Sky for the London Games, and I remember very, very clearly the massive crowds for the women's race compared to the men's. It was at least as big, and bearing in mind that it was absolutely chucking it down for the women's race. And anybody who watched those two and had never watched cycling before, I tell you they'd be won over by the women's race and not the men's race. The men's race was so controlled. We kind of knew what was going to happen, bar the outcome. But with the women's race, it was attack after attack after attack. You know, if you could see a recreation of Lizzie Armitstead against Marianne Vos, as we saw on the Olympic stage, I think it would be absolutely electric. I think it'd be brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, it would be. I can't disagree with any of that. And you're right, the women's road race at the Olympics was a far better, far more entertaining race to watch, and a number of the women's world championship races in recent years have been extremely good as well. And thinking about it, why couldn't they have, say, the women's Tour de France could have started on, say, the second weekend, and it could kind of be the middle part of the tour, so they would have kind of those flat transitional stages as their kind of the first part of the race, and then into the mountains. Whether there would be necessarily the call for 3 weeks straight off the bat, because I don't think if you were inventing the Tour de France now, it wouldn't be 3 weeks long. That's it's only like this because historically it's always lasted this length of time. So, but a 2 week women's Tour de France, yeah, it could work. And if they did it creatively and got it on TV. And you're absolutely right. I mean, what is in the way? The only thing in the way is the publicity caravan or the junk train, and really that could almost.
You can have it running between. You can have a publicity caravan before the women's race, or half of it before the women's race, half of it after the women's race. I don't really see why that couldn't happen. As you say, the distances I don't think are a big deal. In fact, in ultra distance events, women tend to perform often as well as men, and. We're seeing, Marion Vos, Lizzie Armitstead, Laura Trott, there are some real stars coming through or performing at the moment. The tour would give them a platform, and it would. I think there is momentum building, and we're going to have a women's tour of Britain next year. I think that's going to be a big new event for Great Britain and for women's cycling next year, organised by the Tour of Britain.
And you say platform. That's exactly what women's cycling needs, because you've got. Race after race, it's not as bad as that, but you get races cancelled at the last minute in women's cycling, and how on earth can you then sustain female teams, the sponsorship, the races themselves? It's all chicken and egg, really, because I get asked an awful lot why there is no female team Sky. I'm just a Sky Sports reporter, how on earth would I know? But I see the argument for investing in women's sport to begin with, because until there is a set, strong, structured UCI calendar, then why on earth would you pump money into a team that isn't necessarily going to get the races that they're supposed to be promised, and that wouldn't get that exposure? It needs television coverage, and again, the television coverage comes with popularity, it comes with appetite. You're not going to get the appetite if people don't know what it looks like and they don't know how exciting it can be. And so I think if there is a female Tour de France, it has to absolutely be run in conjunction with the male version. You can't have something separate, because, let's be honest, the TV cameras won't turn up. If they're there already and they get to see the action, as at the Olympics, they're going to be covering it anyway. Yeah. Then people see how fantastically exciting it is, and that's when you get the appetite. That's when you get more money, you get more sponsors, you get more TV coverage, and it all starts to be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I mean, interestingly, at the Nocturne a few weeks ago in London, which we were at, Lionel, the women's race was held first and then the men's race. I felt that the crowd was smaller for the men's race. A lot of people were there. The biggest star there was Laura Trott. People were there to see her, and then they kind of some drifted
Dyson
away.
Alex Dyson might not really take kindly to that. But.
Yeah, but I think, rightly or wrongly, Laura Trott is a bigger name in Great Britain because of the Olympics.
Yeah.
And she has this real star quality about her. Yeah. She's such an exciting rider. She almost won that race, in fact. they tried very hard for her to win that race. That's a whole other story.
Yeah.
That's a whole other story. But no, she is. She has got so much star quality. She's 21, 22. She is the Mark Cavendish of women's racing, isn't she?
And you can't underestimate that. I think in Britain especially,
absolutely,
we are blessed with female riders who not just have the talent, they have the character, the personality, that star quality that can really, really, I'm going to go all sort of, Olympic-y on you, but that's the legacy. That's what you want. That's what you want to inspire girls to get on their bikes. Is if they see the likes of Laura Trott and Lizzie and Danny King racing, and then hear their interviews afterwards and learn a little bit about them, then that's how you get people on their bikes.
Thanks for that, Sebastian Cole.
I think the thing is, if you create the event, then the riders will come along. And the other thing is, I've always said, I've put this point to Pat McQuaid many times, and I don't know what the objection is, but to try and incentivise the men's pro teams to run women's pro teams as well. I know Jonathan Vaughters took on it's Emma Pooley's team, wasn't it, for a year or maybe 2 years or whatever, but If you were to say, right, you get a guaranteed Tour de France licence for the next 4 years if you also put a team in the women's Tour de France, you'd have a dozen teams on the start line straight away. I mean, I know the economy is difficult in Europe, funding is an issue, but if you incentivise people with the big carrot of the Tour de France,
yeah,
and
I mean, just to play a sort of devil's advocate, I can see why pro teams don't run women's teams, because they are in it for publicity, and there isn't the publicity. It is, as you say, a chicken and egg situation. The real responsibility does lie with the UCI, I think.
Yeah,
and they are the people who govern the sport. You know, Brian Cookson has made promoting women's cycling a central plank of his campaign to become UCI president. And I read his latest blog today, actually, and he made a good point about the suspicion around Froome, which takes us back to that. But where are the UCI? Where is Pat McQuaid? Why is he not at the biggest bike race in the world? There is, you know, across all these issues that we talk about every day, a lack of leadership.
He'll turn up tomorrow now.
He's coming back at the weekend, though.
We're getting him on the podcast. Right, listen, we've got to get off this mountain. We've got to drive to Aix-les-Bains.
I'm staying for the party, so I don't really care.
Well, you've got the Luxembourg party, haven't you?
I do indeed. Yeah.
Two nights in a row.
Oh yeah.
We're going to be late, Lionel. Just get over it. I think we can get another bowl of crisps. It's okay. Pedaleur de Charme. Let's hear from Ciro.
And now, Pedaleur de Charme.
Thank you, Ciro. Our Pedaleur de Charme. Who's your Pedaleur de Charme today?
Moreno Moser. Absolutely stunning to see him pedal.
Great pedalling.
Great, absolutely
charming
great.
Pedaling.
Charming pedalling, yeah.
Knees, like Frank Schleck style, almost knees brushing the top tube.
Like a marching band, or perfect.
Come on,
absolutely
search perfect. For something better than that, Lionel. Something really charming.
I'm mesmerised.
Stompy.
Stompy.
That's not very smooth.
Yeah.
A march.
No,
is
you're
quite
right. You're right. No. Okay. Like he's treading grapes.
Oh, I don't know if I like that either.
Oh, it's a bit squelchy.
That's not working for me. That's not working for me. I'll nominate Christophe Riblon for his pedalling. off the road and through the ditch and keeping upright. You know, he came right off the road and then somehow remained upright. I don't know how he did that. That took real skill. Our stage winner. Remarkable bit of bike handling there, really. Orla?
Well, I've explained to you both before that one of the idiosyncrasies of covering a bike race for a TV channel is you don't actually get to watch an awful lot, because my job basically involves standing at the finish line, explaining the atmosphere, putting it all into context, grabbing guests, Sean Kelly, the likes. So I didn't get to watch an awful lot, but for that reason, I would have to say my Pedaleur de Charme in general is probably Richie Porte. I think he's done a sterling job, more for his efforts, I suppose, rather than his style.
We've broadened this out to include not just style on a bike, but also off the bike and charm and politeness and so on. So anybody impress you in the mix zone? Or just more generally?
Yeah, a few, actually. I tell you what, there are some riders, this is a hotbed of emotion, intensity, everything, and getting a rider to talk to you can be quite difficult. And I'll move away from, I don't want to be accused of any Team Sky bias, but I'll tell you that Pete Kenyuk and Geraint Thomas are two of the absolute gentlemen of the peloton. They are fantastic. They will always talk to you, no matter what they've been through. They've both shown how hard as nails they are in this year's tour. But I've got to give a special mention, I think, to Omega Pharma Quickstep, Jérôme Pinault. Always got a smile, will always chat. Even if he's had the most ridiculous stage, he's always saying, it's my job, I'm having fun, this is great, I'm at the Tour de France. So any one of those three, take your pick.
Great, thank you very much. Well, thank you, Orla, for joining us. I hope you haven't been too daunted by the occasion.
I won't lie, I'm breaking out in a cold sweat.
I think you're just cold, aren't you?
Yeah, I am just cold and sweaty.
Cold.
Nothing to do with the podcast. But it's been an honour, gentlemen. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, thanks for calling us gentlemen.
And I
hope you will join us again at some point. Lionel, thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Let's go to our hotel.
Run, boys, run.